Well, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us for this event. It's a real pleasure for us to have the opportunity to share with you our thinking on a range of topics. And as you heard, I'm going to talk this morning about some of the issues you heard Mike Rogers talk about and how we're thinking about the need to really keep trust at the core of technology. I think in the first instance, it's helpful to reflect on just what an extraordinary time we are all living and working in. The past year has been an extraordinary year for issues around trust and technology, and we appreciate that you all really are living and working at the front line of these issues. I thought I would start by just providing some context, sharing with you some of what we've seen here at Microsoft, as well as talking about some of the broader events that we've all witnessed together, so we can think a little bit about what they add up to. I'd like to start by focusing on 1 month in the past year. It really was an extraordinary month. It was the first month of 2015, January. And I'd actually like to start with one day, the 21st of January. Now, that happened to be the day here in Redmond when we showed people Windows 10, we unveiled HoloLens for the first time. But for our purposes today, I think it's helpful to look elsewhere, because in another part of the world, it was altogether a different day. In Sao Paulo, Brazil, the day started out like any other. It was a beautiful day, but as it unfolded, the police in Sao Paulo not just knocked on the door, but burst past the security gate of the apartment or flat of one of our employees, the person who's the CFO for Microsoft Brazil. He happened to be up here in Redmond that day, but his wife was home. They demanded that he be produced. They wanted to take him away to be questioned. They have pursued a legal case against him, a criminal case. For what? For being an employee of Microsoft. As it turns out, the Brazilian police were and are investigating another Brazilian citizen who has used Skype. And the Brazilian authorities demanded that Microsoft turn over to them this individual's Skype data. There's only one problem. The Skype data is not in Brazil. It's in the United States. And in fact, if we were to turn over some of the information they are demanding, we would commit a felony under United States law. The only way we can solve this problem is to get the two governments to talk with each other, something that the Brazilian authorities have said they don't want to do. They expect us to respond directly to them. Now, as you can imagine, that actually is the kind of day that makes people lose sleep, especially if you happen to be the CFO of Microsoft Brazil. But in truth, it wasn't the most eventful day of that unusual month. I think the most eventful day by far was earlier in the month, on the 7th of January, on a different continent in France. That was the day where everyone's attention around the world was focused on this horrible attack at Charlie Hebdo. We saw these images of police in the streets of Paris, and even worse, these images of these journalists who were killed. Well, you might ask, what does that have to do with the topic that we're here to talk about this morning? Well, the reality is, by the very next day, the connection was clear. Because as there unfolded in the streets of France, the largest manhunt that the country had seen in over 20 years, we were notified at 5:42 in the morning, before the sun even rose here in Seattle, because it turns out that the two terrorists who were at large had Microsoft email accounts. The French authorities had worked with our government. They had come to the FBI, and the FBI served an emergency order on us. And even though we received that order at 5:42 in the morning, within 45 minutes, we were able to examine the order, verify that it was valid, pull the email accounts, and get that information back to the FBI so they could turn it over to the police. But this issue that, from first glance, had nothing to do with technology connected with technology in a very short period of time. And the connection didn't stop there. Just a few days later, something amazing happened. Using social media, the people of Paris came together, they organized themselves, and that Sunday, on the 11th of January, 2 million people stood together and stood up for the principle of freedom of expression. This was the largest event of its kind that Paris had seen, literally, since Charles de Gaulle led the march down the Champs-Élysées in 1944 after the liberation of the city. Technology, social media, played a role in making that possible. 3 days after that, the technology connection continued because the issues went across the English Channel to London, where Prime Minister Cameron said that the attack on Charlie Hebdo showed that controls on the use of encryption needed to be tightened. And 2 weeks after that, the issue went back across the English Channel again, where French government officials said that the attack showed that the freedom of expression needed to be tightened up on the internet so social media could not be used so readily to recruit terrorists. All of that happened in a single month. And yet it was not just an unusual month, it has been an extraordinary year. And if there is a single day that I think was the most extraordinary day on this extraordinary year, it was this day, the 24th of November. And the place where it all happened was actually in our own country, in Los Angeles. It was a Monday morning, and as people got up and drove to work, some of them drove through this gate. They drove to their offices at Sony Pictures Entertainment. Little could they have possibly imagined that they were about to become part of what Fortune magazine would subsequently call the hack of the century. As investigators got to work, they followed the breadcrumbs, and as we now know, it took them across the Pacific to North Korea. And of course, once it became clear that this was a state-sponsored security attack, the events did not stop there. They came back across the Pacific again to Washington, D.C. And on the 19th of December, the last thing President Obama did before getting on Air Force One to take his annual vacation trip to Hawaii was to give a press conference where he had this to say.
Again, I'm sympathetic that Sony as a private company was worried about liabilities and this and that and the other. I wish they'd spoken to me first. I would have told them, do not get into a pattern in which you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks.
I don't know if that would keep you up at night, but it would probably cause me just to want to go back to bed, because that is not the definition of a good day. First, you have to manage this awful security attack of your computers, and then you have to turn on the television and watch the President of the United States criticize the way your company managed it. That, more than anything, brings to life and illustrates the changing times in which we live. Now, interestingly, that was not the end of the story for technology, even with respect to Sony, because 5 days after that press conference, on the 24th of December, Google and Microsoft and Sony announced together that we were using technology, the internet, to make available the film, The Interview, that had led to this attack in the first place. We were very pleased to stand up for the principle, even if we did subsequently become a little disappointed to learn that it actually wasn't all that great a film. But the principle mattered, and it was the right thing to do. In the months that have followed, all of these things have continued to ripple around the world. In February, we saw concerns emanate from Beijing as U.S. and other companies expressed concerns about new proposals that the Chinese government was considering. We've seen concerns focused on Moscow and the Russian proposals relating to data residency. Even in Washington, our own FBI director, Jim Comey, has been calling for tighter controls on the use of encryption. Ultimately, I don't think one can do your job our job unless we start by asking ourselves a fairly simple question. What is going on? Now, interestingly, if you just take the countries that I have shown, you can see how much of the world they cover. And as you can imagine, we follow these issues around the world. This map shows you in red the countries that have adopted new laws or regulations on data residency, basically rules that would require that certain data stay in data centers in those countries. The countries in yellow are debating these proposals. This map shows you what's happening with respect to security requirements. This shows you what's happening with respect to encryption. We're seeing an even broader number of countries adopt new rules seeking to apply warrants extraterritorially, meaning they're trying to reach into data centers in other countries. And we're seeing new content restrictions as well. Of course, all of this has grown even further over the last 2 weeks when the European Court of Justice invalidated the safe harbor agreement that 4,000 companies had been using to move data from Europe to the United States. As we said that day, thank goodness we had spent 5 years of engineering and legal resources to invest in the creation of model clauses agreements, and thank goodness those are still standing. But all of this underscores just how much uncertainty is being created for the use of technology. I think it calls on one to ask some other questions. Not only what is going on, but why? Why is this happening? Why is it happening now? Well, I think all of us know that at a certain level, it's because of this fellow. Edward Snowden took 4 laptops, got on an airplane, and as he shared more information with people around the world, trust in technology was put under threat. But there's more to it than that. I think that these trends reflect as well just the fundamental role that the internet is playing in society today. Think about the multifaceted role the internet played in some of the examples I showed you. In Paris, the internet was used not just to recruit terrorists, but to proclaim credit via YouTube after the attack. But it was also used by the French authorities to investigate the crime and to mobilize the people of France to stand together. Think about Sony. The internet was used to stage the attack, and it was used to put the film out to the public and defend the freedom of expression that was at stake. More than ever, the internet is not some other place that is disconnected from the real world. It is fundamentally the central place where people go when they want to influence what happens in the real world. And as we all recognize, the internet has made the world a smaller place. It is reminiscent of what the first Apollo astronauts saw when they circled the moon and reflected on the fact that there are no borders in space. But here on Earth, borders still matter. Mike Rogers made that plain this morning. Borders are of great importance. National security is more important than ever. And if one thing was made clear last November by the attack on Sony, it is this. There is no national security without cybersecurity. And I think this, as much as anything else, both explains what has been going on and makes clear that this issue is not going to go away. Instead, we need to ask ourselves, what is it that we can do? What is it that we should do? What is it that we should do to, frankly, navigate an incredibly tumultuous time? And I'll admit there are days when I go to Washington and other capitals with others in our industry, and you know, I hear people complain, and that's completely legitimate because these are difficult problems that many days governments do not necessarily make better. But when I listen to people complain, I sometimes think that they're just shouting at the wind. And if there's one thing that is perfectly clear at this point, success is not going to come from shouting at the wind. Success is only going to come if we can figure out how to ride the wave. And that is a hard challenge. We have spent a lot of time here at Microsoft talking about the best way to approach this, including with Satya and our senior leadership team. And the more we thought about it, the more we concluded that fundamentally what we had to do was start by identifying the values for which we wanted to stand. Then we had to take that and turn it into principles, and we needed to build that with concrete commitments we could make to different stakeholders and customers. As we thought about the values, to me, one of the most powerful statements was one that Satya made to our employees last July. Fundamentally, what he said is this: we need technology to move forward, but we need technology to move forward in a way that ensures that timeless values will endure. That is our North Star. So we asked ourselves, okay, what is it that we want to stand for? What is it that we can do? And interestingly, as we had these discussions and debates internally, we realized in a pretty important way that on the 1st of February, we had already answered this question. We answered it when we showed over 100 million people during the Super Bowl this short video.
The real question that needs to be asked as well as answered is, what is it that we can do that is unique, that is impactful?
When Bray was 11 months old, he was fitted for his first pair of prostheses.
We are going to empower every individual and every organization to do more and achieve more.
We'd use Microsoft technology to analyze Braylon's gait mechanics.
It's this process of continuous renewal, of showing courage in the face of reality.
I think the technology has changed Braylon's life by opening up the world for him.
Keep going. Showing that courage in the face of opportunity.
In effect, Satya has defined for this company a new mission. And it's one that we talk about, I have to say, as somebody who's been here 22 years, far more than we talked about our prior mission statements. Our mission is to empower every person and organization on the planet to achieve more. And it is obvious when you think about it, if we're going to empower every person, we have to protect every person. That is, in a sense, where it starts. It really requires that we take a principled approach. Now, this is also easier said than done, because the fundamental aspect that makes this issue so complicated is that there are very important principles that are in tension with each other. We need to live in a world where the public is safe. I think Mike Rogers, when he was in Congress, stood for that principle, perhaps as much or more than any other member of Congress. But we also want to live in a world where people have a sense of privacy and people can express their views. We need to live in a world where there's respect for borders. There will be no peace in the world if that doesn't happen, but we also want to live in a world where there is an open set of markets and there is a global internet. Now, the good news is that there are some principles that one can use to cut through these. Transparency, almost all the time, is very helpful. The more we can share about what we are doing, the more we can advance all of these principles. And fundamentally, we've definitely concluded that we need an internet governed by law, but it needs to be good law. The age of people in tech saying cyberspace should be some place where law doesn't touch, it just doesn't work. Because it's clear we can't keep people safe in the real world unless we can keep them safe on the internet. And we can't protect people's rights in the real world unless we can protect their rights on the internet. And that does require good laws. What it also requires is that we move from these principles to commitments. And so we've thought a lot about three sets of commitments. One is a set of promises to governments. We've gone out and we've been comfortable saying to governments all around the world that we do believe it is part of our role to protect their digital security, to respect their digital sovereignty, and to do business in a way that promotes their local economy. As you can imagine, there's a lot more detail underlying each of these. I want to talk more today about our commitments to others, our commitment to customers, really starting with the enterprise. The good news is we have been working on this, Microsoft last April became the first company in the industry to win approval from every single data protection authority in Europe for our model clauses. And the day we got that approval, we said that one of the reasons we had spent all of this time and money and effort to go get this was because if there came a day when the EU safe harbor collapsed, there would be an alternative legal foundation on which customers could rely to move their information. We built on that further, and this year, Microsoft became the first company in our industry to win certification for the new ISO 27018 standard, which involves very specific commitments around privacy and security. But we've thought about one other aspect as well. It's not enough just to be a voice for people in the enterprise. We want to be a voice for people more broadly as well. I would probably argue that over the 40 years of this company's existence, there's no other tech company that has done more to help create a voice for people. We've created the technology and the tools that have enabled people to express their views, to communicate with each other, to share their ideas, to learn about each other and the world. And we want to continue to do that. So whether people are home as consumers or employees in an enterprise, there are four commitments that we decided we wanted to make. We wanted to stand up before the world as we have and say, if you give us your data, we will keep it secure. We will recognize that your data is your data. It does not belong to us, it belongs to you. We will keep it private, it will be under your control. We felt we needed to really put a stake in the ground and say, we will manage your data in accordance with the law. You shouldn't have to go to law school to store your information in the cloud. We have 450 people who work here who did go to law school. They're in 55 countries around the world. We rely on them to manage your data in accordance with the law. And perhaps most fundamentally, we believe in transparency, in letting you know what we are doing with your information. In the enterprise, we have been able to go even farther, especially because of all the engineering work we did to win certification under ISO 27018. So we're able to commit to very strong and very specific security safeguards. We're able to say contractually to you, we will only process your personal information pursuant to your instructions and in no other way. We are focused on building out regulatory compliance for a series of vertical industries, from finance to healthcare to manufacturing and transportation and others. We will disclose to you every time we can, and we will go to court if we need to, so we can, if governments are seeking access to your data, because all of this, again, rests on transparency. We've also recognized that having commitments on paper is important, but they actually only matter if we can put them into practice. That's what we've been focused on doing. We've been working to back these commitments, first, by investments in technology. We're spending over $8 billion a year in capital expenditures to build data centers. That's why we can say we now have over 100 data centers. They operate in 19 regions around the world. They're in over 40 countries. That's what increasingly enables us to say, if you're an enterprise, you can decide where in the world you want your data stored. You can choose your region, and you can do so with confidence that your data will remain there. It's also what enables us, I think, to be the only company in the industry to say, you can choose how you want a cloud service to be run. If you want to use our public cloud, you can do that. If you want to use our services that run in a partner, you can do that. If you want to use our technology and run it yourself at the edge of our cloud in your own server room or your own data center, you can do that as well. We recognize it's a diverse world. Customers have diverse needs. You all should be able to choose. We've also, I think, as well or at least as much or perhaps even more than any other company in the industry, been working to back these commitments with our legal resources. It's why we made what was frankly a very difficult set of decisions to sue our own government, the United States government, not once, but three times. The first time was 2 years ago when we and then Google filed lawsuits arguing that we had a right under the First Amendment to the Constitution to share more information with the public about the kinds of national security orders and letters and requests we were receiving. We argued that this could be done in a sensible way that would not compromise national security, and that fundamentally we had a right to make that information available. It was an unusual case because it went before an unusual court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. This is not a typical court. A typical court has an address, it has a courthouse. This one does not. A typical court has the telephone numbers published of all the people who work there. This one does not. This has a single phone number, and when you call that phone number, you don't actually have a human being who answers the call. Instead, you hear this.
You have reached the United States Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Please leave a message.
That was not the end of the unusual characteristics associated with this particular lawsuit. We filed our brief, as we do in every lawsuit, and of course you then wait for the brief from the other side so you can see what the other lawyers are arguing against you, knowing what the judge is going to read. Well, in this case, when the other side's brief, the brief from the government, came back, what we found was that it looked like this, and we weren't actually even able to read everything that the government was arguing. It's why we continued to advance the case in court, but we took our case as well to the White House. And the good news is last January 17th, President Obama, as he's depicted in this picture, went over to the Justice Department and he gave a speech that said that there were steps the government would take to reform our surveillance laws. And that same evening, we got a phone call from the Justice Department that said, we will settle your case. And they settled it in ways that now permit us every 6 months to publish information about the kind and number of orders that we're receiving and the number of accounts that are affected. Unfortunately, that was not the only lawsuit we felt compelled to bring. We brought a second case, and I think the second case, if anything, may concern you in this room as much or more than anything else. Because we put a stake in the ground. If a legitimate enterprise stores its data in our data center and the government wants access to it, it should not come to us, it should come to you. And when the government did serve a subpoena on us, seeking the information of a legitimate business, we did go to court. And as we started to make progress in court, the FBI withdrew that subpoena. And that's why I can stand here today and say we continue to be committed to the principle that if somebody is an enterprise customer, meaning they have 50 or more seats with us, and they are a legitimate business, meaning unless the government persuades us through some very strong evidence that a business is not legitimate in the first place, we're going to court before we turn over information to the government that belongs to you, not to us. And then there's a final case as well. It's one that has been in the news more than any of the others. It concerns our data center in Ireland. It concerns an individual who lives outside the United States. We store email, for example, in data centers that are closer to our customers. The US government has taken the position that despite the fact that the individual and the data center and the data are all outside the United States, it can use a US search warrant to reach it. And our answer is we don't actually think that's the way Congress intended for the law to work. It is not how laws work in general. We have this thing called borders. We have this thing called diplomatic relations. This is the government of Ireland. It is not Iran. We produce testimony from the former Attorney General of Ireland saying that the Irish government will work with U.S. authorities, and that's the right way to get things done. That case is pending. This is a case that many people say may go to the Supreme Court. It's a case that we've said we'll take to the Supreme Court if that is what it takes to sort this out. And what is interesting is to see the support that has grown along the way. Last December in New York, there was a day when a number of entities filed amicus or friend of the court briefs on our behalf. It included 28 major technology and media companies, 23 trade association and advocacy groups, 35 of the leading computer scientists in this country, and the government of Ireland itself. I believe that that day was the only day in 2014 where Fox News and the ACLU actually were on the same side of an issue. It shows how broad the support it is. And we're taking this to Congress as well, where legislation has been introduced that now has almost 100 co-sponsors in the House and 15 in the Senate. Ultimately, we believe these are the kinds of commitments that need to be backed by a strong community of supporters. We believe in keeping the public safe, and we believe in protecting privacy and people's rights to freedom of expression. We believe that people need to trust in technology. That is fundamentally what this is all about. You can't do your jobs unless the people who work at your companies trust in the technology that you provide them. We cannot do our jobs if people around the world do not trust in the technology that we create. But as much as anything else, if we're going to empower the world, if we're going to protect the world, we need to continue to create technology that the world can trust. Thank you very much.